40 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.
I'm Monica Ricks in New York. Thousands are dead and hundreds more people are injured following a massive 7.2 magnitude earthquake in Turkey and Syria. Ismail Al-Abdullah is with a relief group called the White Helmets. They're digging through rubble to search for survivors.
It's a very difficult task for us. We need help. We need the international community to do something.
CBS's Tina Kraus reports from our foreign desk in London.
The powerful earthquake struck near the border of Turkey and Syria as people slept. And daylight revealed the scale of the disaster. This man says 12 families were trapped here and no one managed to get out. Rescuers worked quickly and carefully in the bitter cold. Some still buried in the rubble posted videos on social media begging for help.
Turkey's president has declared a 7-day mourning period for those victims. Here at home, President Biden is weighing in on the tragedy. He says he's deeply saddened by the loss of life and devastation. The U.S. has already sent 2 search and rescue teams to the region to help. Meantime, U.S. military and law enforcement continue to collect debris from that Chinese surveillance balloon that was shot down over the weekend. CBS's Kimmy McCormick.
Recovery crews were able to retrieve some debris yesterday, but sea conditions prevented underwater crews from searching the area. They're at work today, and they include explosive ordnance teams. A U.S. commander says they're concerned about hazardous debris and possibly even explosives, and they're asking the public if debris washes up on shore to avoid contact and notify law enforcement.
Authorities in Ohio plan to release toxic chemicals from 5 cars of a derailed train in East Palestine to avoid a huge explosion. That controlled release starts in about 2 hours. Investigators in Maryland stopped 2 suspects from shooting up several power substations that would have left thousands in the cold near Baltimore. FBI special agent in charge Thomas Sobosinski says a woman was recorded telling an undercover agent about the plan.
Marylanders can rest assured that a threat to disrupt their daily lives by attacking the local power grid has been stopped.
Those suspects were neo-Nazi extremists. 2 children who were kidnapped by their mother in Missouri have now been found in Florida. CBS's Wendy Gillette.
The 2 abducted children were found last week in a supermarket in High Springs, Florida, near Gainesville, with their mother, who did not have custody. 36-year-old Christy Gilley. Police located Gilley after running a routine vehicle check that showed she was a fugitive. Gilley remains in jail. The 2 children, who are now 11 and 12 years old, were abducted last March from Clay County, Missouri, a suburb of Kansas City.
Police say they'll be reunited with their family soon. This is CBS News.
The Shaw 101 FM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Nadnair. Here's what you need to know. 16 years in prison for a Wisconsin man convicted of shooting at children throwing snowballs at his car in Milwaukee. William Carson found guilty in 2 counts for first-degree reckless injury, 5 counts of first-degree recklessly endangering safety. 2 of the kids Carson shot at were struck by bullets in the thigh and arm. Another child was grazed. Enrollment numbers at Wisconsin's Technical College are up, while 4-year college enrollments continue dropping. Last year, tech colleges saw a 10% increase in enrollment. Wisconsin's private 4-year university saw a drop of 12%. Public 4-year college enrollment down 2%. National data shows that surrounding states have seen an even larger enrollment decline. This isn't unexpected, though. Lower birth rates resulted in fewer students entering and graduating from high school. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
The Civic Media team would like to say congratulations. More than 200 Wisconsin businesses and nonprofits are receiving a free advertising campaign through our one-day $1 million advertising giveaway. If you missed out, our local sales team would still love to help you with your own campaign. Go to civicmedia.us and click on the sponsorship tab. Again, civicmedia.us and sponsorship. New and still growing. Advertise today with a Civic Media network of radio stations.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. We talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
You've got questions about navigating the healthcare system? Kristen Lyerly helps us find answers and discusses other issues at the intersection of healthcare and politics. Hometown Health, Thursday mornings at 7:30 on Up North News Radio.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK, 540 AM, Waukesha's only news talk station. The Shaw, 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Big Bend to Menominee Falls, always streaming.
Approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So waiting for the fallout from the six dictators in robes to come down with their decision on the Glacier Northwest versus Teamster case, which is going to dramatically, if it goes the way that I think it's going to go. In fact, most people that I talk to think it's going to go. It's going to dramatically change how workers and their unions fight for better wages, hours, conditions, have their voices heard in the workplace. It's going to make things dramatically different. That's why I've asked a couple of experts to come and explain it to us a little bit better, share some thoughts on what might happen, and, well, how horrible this could be down the road if decided the way that, again, I think it's going to come down. That's why I've asked Ben Sachs to come talk with us. He's the Kastenbaum Professor of Labor and Industry at Harvard Law School. And Sharon Block, she's a professor of practice and the executive director of the Center for Labor and a Just Economy. Guys, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to get into this case. A lot of people don't know what the Glacier case is. So Ben, if you could just give me a quick overview, you know, what did the Supreme Court hear in this case of Glacier Northwest versus Teamsters 117? What's the crux of it?
So the crux is, can you sue a union for striking? can an employer sue a union for striking and get damages if the union costs the employer money? The case itself involves cement truck drivers who went on strike. The guys who had early shifts had cement in their trucks already, so they drove the trucks back to the plant, left the barrels rotating so that the cement wouldn't dry in the trucks. But some of the cement got ruined because it didn't get delivered on time because of the strike. The normal course here is, if the employer thinks it's an illegal strike or an unfair labor practice, the employer can take action against the workers. But probably this was a protected strike. So what the employer did was it sued the union in state court seeking damages, saying that the union had engaged in what was tantamount to vandalism. And, you know, 99 times out of 100, a case like this gets in front of a state court and the state court dismisses the case and says, we don't do this in the United States. We don't give damages for strikes. And we let the National Labor Relations Board sort out the labor law questions involved. That's exactly what the Washington State Supreme Court said. But the Supreme Court took the case, indicating that it wants to give state courts the right to hear these lawsuits about strikes. And so that's very scary. This Supreme Court probably didn't take this case to say that the state Supreme Court was right. And the oral arguments that was heard a couple of weeks ago suggest to me and to Sharon and to everybody who's paying attention that the unions are going to lose. And the question is how badly and how broad a right to sue for strike damages there will be after the Supreme Court decides the case.
Now, Sharon, you're someone who served on the National Labor Relations Board. How much this is, if this goes the way that I think, as Ben points out, everyone thinks it's going to go, how much is this taking away from the board's ability to oversee this stuff? How much of this is taking away from the board?
Yeah, it's absolutely undermining the board's authority. We, for decades and decades, have had one body that has the expertise and the authority to make these kinds of judgment calls about whether strikes should be protected or not. And if state courts can start getting involved and start making pronouncements about labor issues before the NLRB has a chance to even look at the case, it's very much going to undermine the NLRB's authority and then, you know, create inconsistent results all over the country, which is going to be very destabilizing for unions because they won't have that predictability. There won't be one place to go to know that there are experts who are going to look at the case and make that judgment call in the first instance.
Well, ultimately, I believe that's the Alito plan, and given his track record. But in looking at this, and again, as Ben pointed out, this is about suing the unions for damages when a strike happens. So if you know, a union representing farm workers decides they're going to go on strike, you know, will the farm be able to sue those workers for crops that they didn't pick? You know, will, you know, name the industry? Will is this where this is going to take us, to where there's going to be a massive chilling effect on workers' ability to use the only power that they really have, and that's to fold their arms and march their feet?
Yeah, I mean, so it's absolutely, you can imagine just sort of the slippery slope from the facts of this case to all kinds of strikes where there is some economic effect on the employer. I mean, after all, that is the point of a strike, is to have some economic impact on the employer. But, you know, I don't even think, I think this is so bad that we won't even get necessarily to a point where employers are frequently suing unions. They'll just have to threaten it. And that will change the calculus for unions about whether to even ask their members to go out on strike.
That's an interesting point. So Ben, let me ask you, because, you know, one of the things I said from the beginning is this could set up another scenario of what, you know, what right-wing groups have been doing for years with a lot of frivolous lawsuits against unions. In fact, you know, since the Janus decision, unions across the country have been sued because they've taken dues a particular month when they maybe shouldn't have, or didn't refund things fast enough. And it was really just about creating an environment of more frivolous lawsuits to chew up dues dollars and keep unions fighting to just maintain their ability to exist, as opposed to going out and organizing, doing more. Wouldn't that be also part of this? Which do you see?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to just agree with Sharon here and say, in some ways, the scenario you just described might be the best case scenario, in which the lawsuits are frivolous. so there's a very narrow exception in the law today, which says that if a union engages in, or workers engage in, violence on the picket line or outright vandalism during a strike, then the union can be subject to a lawsuit. And what the Supreme Court is going to do is it's going to expand on that exception and define vandalism or picket line violence much more broadly to include some kind of property destruction. And Sharon's got it exactly right. The question is, what does property destruction mean? Does it mean just something like letting the cement harden before it can be delivered? Or does it mean, as you suggested, Rick, letting crops go bad? If supermarket workers go out on strike and some of the food spoils, is that property destruction? Or are lost profits property destruction? And we don't know what the Supreme Court will say. They could say any of those things. But Sharon's got it exactly right. Whatever they say, they're going to expand the definition of what property destruction means.
Yeah.
And invite lawsuits of the kind that you're you're discussing. And yes, so that's going to be deeply destabilizing and even further undermine the strike right that's already so compromised by terrible Supreme Court decisions that we've had over the last handful of years.
No, because this is one of those things, and Sharon, I want to go back to you because, you know, one of the things that's concerning to me is because he said lost profits, you know, by withholding my labor, you know, can I now be sued for not working because they didn't realize profits they didn't have? Because, look, there's a potential that UPS is going to go on strike this summer. Could UPS inevitably sue the Teamsters Union for profits that they didn't make because those packages didn't get delivered? Could this take, and this is that slippery slope, could this take us in that direction?
Right, and that's exactly the point, is we won't know the answer to that question. You know, the court will, like Ben said, expand this definition. We've seen them play this game before where they use sort of imprecise words that other courts can then take and expand even further. And now you've got the basis for lawsuits all over the country trying to define whatever this new definition that the court will put in its opinion. And so you've got, even before, you know, the cases get back to the Supreme Court or these lawsuits are even resolved, you've got unions having to defend themselves in court, which cost, you know, dues members money to just even, you know, try to have this right that has been so important since the act was passed. And now there's almost like a tax on it because of, at the very best, uncertainty that we'll have about how far this court is really willing to go.
Now, see, here's the thing, and this is where I'm not the legal experts. You guys are. It's my understanding that the original National Labor Relations Act did not give employers any rights whatsoever because they understood employers had all the rights to begin with. This was simply about giving workers the ability to have some voice and had a government push to try and encourage people into collective bargaining so that it was kind of a peace treaty, in my view. Again, not the legal expert, but Ben, you as the professor, you know, explain a little bit about the intent there, because this seems to me miles away from that original intent.
Yeah, I mean, the way I read the National Labor Relations Act is as giving workers a source of countervailing power to fight against the power that comes from the ownership of capital that the employers have. The law is written in broad sort of constitution-like terms. The right to engage in concerted activity for mutual aid and protection. The statute says that the right to strike shall be preserved, and it's really been the court that's chipped away at the meaning of the statute, at the sort of radical potential of the statute over the years. And, you know, Congress did some damage in 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Act, but it's been the court, particularly in recent years, that's, you know, started to take a sledgehammer to the rights that are enshrined in the Labor Act.
No, it's scary. So let me ask you, Sharon, because the other part of this is we see a lot of organizing going on. We see a lot of activity. You look at Starbucks. You look at, there's a lot going on around getting Amazon organized. REI, I mean, you can go down the list of the organizing campaigns that are going on. There are more strikes that are happening. Over the summer, we saw a number of them across the country. This seems, well, interesting timing. It seems like the goal is to quash that and to keep, you know, keep wages where they are. I look at this in this moment going, it seems curious to me. I guess that's where I'm at.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that the court decided to hear this case was somewhat of a surprise. This was not an issue where you've seen a lot of activity, you know, in the lower courts. That's usually a signal that an issue's getting churned up and needs the court to step in and sort of settle the law. That's not what was going on here. So it does feel like the court reached out to decide this issue, to elevate this issue, because they've got an agenda to accomplish. And it's hard to escape that. I don't say that lightly, but it's hard to escape that conclusion if you look at what the court has done in cases involving unions over the past few years.
Almost my entire working life. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Ben Sachs. He's the Kastenbaum Professor of Labor and Industry at Harvard Law School. Also, Sharon Block is here with us. She's the Executive Director of the Center for Labor and a Just Economy. Their website, you might want to check out, clje.law.harvard.edu. We'll get links out on social media. Much easier to get. They also run the On Labor blog, their blog, onlabor.org. Also, we'll get links out on how you can take a look at that. Now, again, I come back to this organizing. I do believe that if this goes the way I think we all expect it to go, it's going to put a chilling effect on organizing. But the reality is, and my old school friends like to remind me, that sit-down strikes and other tactics of the past were also illegal, but workers, you know, still rose to the occasion. Do you have hope that the future still, we're going to find ways around this, or thoughts? Let's start with you, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, I've been incredibly inspired and moved by the heroism of American workers over the past few years who have organized in the face of terrible odds and unbelievable hurdles. Yeah, absolutely. Working people will figure out how to deal with the Supreme Court and continue to organize unions and continue to build power. Our perspective on this is it shouldn't be so hard. It shouldn't take heroic efforts to form a union. It should be everybody's right. And that the failure here is American labor law. And the Supreme Court has bears a lot of responsibility for the failure of American labor law. But the purpose of our labor law is to enable working people to choose unions, to form unions and to collectively bargain. And that's failing right now. And we need to step up and rebuild this legal system so that it does facilitate workers' right to choose a union.
No, it is way too hard. As someone who's done organizing over the years, it's way too difficult. You know, I remember stories from my grandparents and their generation that it was nowhere near this difficult. And what we need is that kind of mass organizing again. Because look, we're suffering through some massive inflation. And I keep telling people the way forward in this is people fighting for better wages, hours, conditions. When you have cost of living adjustments in your union contracts, inflation doesn't hurt you as much. We need policies that are going to help working families make it through to tomorrow. And I think, you know, in the president's State of the Union on Tuesday, I think he's got to come out and talk about this as well, that there's got to be a path for workers to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, to help ease the pain, because corporate profits are through the roof. Workers should be getting a portion of that. At least that's my thought. Sharon, I want to get yours.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's important for the president to make clear that he doesn't believe that the path to bringing down inflation is on the backs of workers by doing things like trying to raise the unemployment rate, like we see, you know, we believe the Fed is trying to do. And similarly, to just make clear that it's not this administration's policy to try to stifle wage increases as a way of containing inflation. That's not what's, I mean, I'm not an economist, but from economists that I trust, their views is that is not what's causing inflation. And so, I think you will hear that from the president. I think this is a president who takes very seriously when people refer to him as the most pro-union president in generations. And so I will certainly be listening for that. And I believe that's what we'll hear in some form or fashion.
Ben, any thoughts on the president's speech?
Yeah, just to completely agree with Sharon. And it would be great to hear something of support for unions and some agenda for, you know, making unionization a little bit easier over the next years of this administration.
Yeah, that'd be great. Last line of questioning I've got for you, because I noticed last week you guys opened a new Center for Labor and a Just Economy. Great stuff. I hope folks will check out the website. We will get links out, clje.law.harvard.edu. Tell me, as the executive director, Sharon, what's the goal? What made you guys want to start this?
Thanks so much for the question. I mean, what made us want to start this is that this is a moment, like we've been talking about, where you see this incredible momentum and energy coming from workers and this inability of the law to translate that desire into the results that the law should be protecting. So we want to be a place where we help come up with ideas about how the law can better facilitate moving workers' desire to create power into the reality of a fairer and a more just economy.
So using some of the things, and look, I got to tell you, I love the new head of the NLRB, Jennifer Abruzzo. I love the things that she's doing, and the fact that, you know, using you know, legal doctrine that hasn't been used in a very long time. I think we need to be doing that in ways that we haven't for decades. The right has got all of these think tanks that set up, you know, ways of abusing the law. It'd be great for us to figure out what you're doing to help use the law to help working people. So I think that's a good start.
Great. Well, thank you. Stay tuned.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We want you to come back and share some thoughts. So last thought, Ben, what are you hoping to, as somebody who's involved in this Center for Labor and a Just Economy, what's your goal? What's your hope for it?
Yeah, just to build off what you said about Jen Abruzzo, I mean, she's doing amazing things at the NLRB. She's using all the tools that she has available to her. Our view is that they're not powerful enough and that we need a different labor law, not just this one improved. We need to do things like sectoral bargaining. We need to give people just cause dismissal protection and really rethink labor law from the ground up to enable people to choose a union.
No, that's incredible stuff. And the hope is you'll come back and when you get this, we can talk about those because those are really important topics that I think we need to express and discuss. I don't think we talk enough about labor law. I know it's not sexy. It's not balloons. We're not talking about balloons. But I think we should be talking about labor law and how people can fight for better wages, hours, conditions. Guys, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you. Take care.
Outstanding. I appreciate the time, Sharon Block and Ben Sachs. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the talk.
Are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible 2-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Wow, I got to tell you, the Center for Labor and a Just Economy sounds like a great idea. Would have been great 30 years ago. Here's the thing. This is where the left and labor hasn't done enough of getting their message out. You know, you throw something out on social media and immediately the trolls got the talking points, all the talking points that they regurgitate them ad nauseum. And yet, working people who look, you got to have the tools to fight back against that. I've had people make accusations like the one today that caught my attention. A woman on social media said, my husband works for a union company and they're in bed with the union and the company are in bed together. In fact, she said, the CEO of the company is on the board of the union. And you go, no, that's illegal. That would never happen. But there are people who throw this stuff out there. And if it goes unchallenged, if you don't have the tools and the knowledge to go, no, that's not how our system works. People buy it. And if they repeat it enough, this is what the right understands masterfully, which is why right-wing talk radio was, you know, was so important to their dominance of the message machine. Ad nauseum, they keep pounding the message. The outrage candy is plentiful. They never run out of anger, and they never run out of
WAUK 540 AM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. A 7.8 magnitude earthquake in Turkey and Syria has killed more than 2,600 people, and there could be more bodies trapped under buildings. This man says the shaking started in the middle of the night.
Just instinctively, we just ran for our lives out of the building. And then we saw other families just coming out, running for their lives as well from the building.
Authorities in East Palestine, Ohio are warning people a train derailment with dangerous chemicals on board could still blow up. Charles Emmix with the Red Cross.
Chaotic. A lot of people don't want to leave their house. They don't understand what the dangers are. Some of them have pets at their home, and it's hard to convince them to get out.
Retired General H.R. McMaster says that Chinese spy balloon clearly violated international law.
Part of a sustained campaign of espionage against the United States. So I'm hoping this is kind of a wake-up call for all of us.
Crews are still working to recover its pieces. CBS News Brief. I'm Monica Ricks.
The Shaw 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
4 Civic Media, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. A former Trump campaign official and Republican operative is apparently the person who gave a reporter audio of Trump campaign officials in Wisconsin admitting they'd lost in 2020, but planning to promote election fraud claims anyway. The anonymous tipster said they chose to share it after Trump announced another run for president. The former Trump staffer wants to keep their name out of the story out of concern about retaliation. 32 deer at a southwest Wisconsin deer farm were recently put down after a chronic wasting disease outbreak. The state quarantined the farm in September after a buck tested positive. After that, three other deer tested positive. The state is paying the farm owner for the deer, but the farm is also banned from having any more deer for 5 years. In sports, the Bucks are at Portland tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripes Cast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
This is Pat Greitlow from Up North News Radio. On the air, online, or on demand, make it a point to catch the first word on Wisconsin news, sports, and more weekday mornings from 6 to 8 all across the stations of the Civic Media Radio Network.
Wait a minute. How about this? Listen to me, you lantern-jawed cretin, you horned-eyed homunculus. You are going to do what's right for the people of Wisconsin. You're putting cans of water in our water, destroying the greatest university system in the country and public education. Knock it off. That is unlikely to be said. That's what I'd say.
Tune in to Matt Flynn Direct, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m.
You're not too cool for me. And in return, I reciprocate that sentiment. I'll never be too cool for you. I was a man with a plan, but now I'm a dad with a decree, and you can't take that from me. Please let it be noted that I told my job they can dock my pay. Right now, it's just too important to take you to school every day. I want to be legendary for you. I want you to puff out your chest when you go to school the same way I do. I walk taller because of you, because I found everything to live for.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
State and national proposal to prevent addiction and actually lead to a smoke-free future. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, we should be outraged that Santos, a flagrant political fake, has swindled his way into Congress and he should be ousted. But what will Congress do about the far more destructive corporate deceivers who are George Santos's role models? Their lies kill people, yet they're still welcome in the halls of Congress.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Here's a fun story. A neo-Nazi leader and his girlfriend, evidently in court, accused of plotting to attack a Maryland power grid. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, evidently the woman said, you know, if we can pull off what I'm hoping, it'll be legendary. Because, you know, of course, you know, neo-Nazis blowing up power grids is exactly, you know, would be legendary. Now, again, the attack on our power grid by crazy right-wing people, not new. Think of North Carolina not too long ago. Out in Oregon, there was a plot. There's a lot of this stuff going on. And my only message for those folks is you better hope the police and the FBI catch you before my IBEW friends do, because they're going to have to clean up the mess that you make. So shame on you. Shame on you if they get a hold of you. Just saying. Just saying. Anyway, here are some thoughts on the upcoming State of the Union and the top stories of the day. Our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Nay. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So, what do you think? We got these crazy people wanting to blow up our electric grid. I don't get it.
Well, here's what's really crazy. This was her quote. I think the lady was from Maryland, and here's her quote. If we can pull off what I'm hoping, this would be legendary.
Yeah.
It would be disgusting, but it wouldn't be legendary. There's a lot of other legendary things. The balloon is more legendary
The balloon. I stole your picture from the balloon of the people throwing bottles up in the sky.
Oh, is that good?
Because I think that's
what?
Brilliant.
It's Myrtle. It's down at Myrtle Beach, and he's throwing a beer. I think it's a Corona. He's throwing a beer bottle in the air, and the camera catches it, and his wife's there, and there's some debris on the ground, Dixie cups or something. It's like, I put on my captions, you know, this is what the Chinese saw transmitted back to China.
No, it's crazy. And in fact, I stole it and I tweeted it out myself. But I got to get your thoughts on the balloon, because, you know, as I said earlier in the show, you know, I grew up at the end of the Cold War. This kind of stuff happened. We didn't freak out. There weren't a bunch of, you know, paper tiger tough guys dressing up in cosplay outfits like they're military people with their big guns going to shoot up into the sky. We didn't scare that easy. Any thoughts on your end?
Well, I put in my news notes today. I send to all the stations I do, and I put in there, you know, I mean, if people want to talk about it after today, you know, fine, but I'm like ballooned out. Now, we unfortunately are not going to be ballooned out because there's going to be investigations. And here's a little nugget, and you know this from the Hill, Capitol Hill, but I love to give these nuggets. I've seen this 100 times. It happens with the Democrats, happens with the Republicans. Somebody will investigate this now, okay? There'll be a subcommittee or something. Somebody will run to the speaker and they'll say, but it's in my jurisdiction. I want to investigate this too. That's why there was 900 different Benghazi committees. Yeah. Everybody now wants a piece of the media pie. And that's what will happen on this thing. We're going to be, you know, there was a balloon. Sure, it's a spy balloon. It's not a weather balloon. And there's the other thing. China's all outraged. You shot down an unmanned, you know, civilian piece of equipment. And then the other thing is, it was not worth shooting down where somebody would die. So, you know, so they waited. And then they didn't give all this away, but you can tell because there were U-2 spy planes going around it, all right? So you can bet something electronically was interfering then with its transmission. I'll just say that much. Something electronically from the U-2s were messing up transmission back to China.
But you know, the thing that got me, Bob, is this idea that this has never happened before. This never happens. We're America. Nothing like this ever. And yet I grew up in an era where, you know, this did happen. There were Russian submarines off the coast. They were always there. Or am I missing something?
U-2 spy planes, you know, we had them. They send things. There's, you know, things in our atmosphere, things in their atmosphere. And it happens a lot.
Yeah. How soon do they shoot down one of our drones?
Visually, everybody saw.
Right. How soon do they shoot down one of our drones?
I mean, when they see them, they're going to shoot them, you know. depends where it's at. Now, here's the other thing now, of course, there's a difference. This was three school trucks high, and, you know, and loaded with different, as I understand it, types of metal and equipment and things. No, the drones are a little bit easier to, you know, you blast those into tiny little pieces.
Yeah, it's just, it's crazy to me. Just crazy that we are this skittish and divided. So what I said, this was a trial balloon. And the trial balloon was to see how we would react. And congratulations, we failed.
Well, as I've told many people the last couple of days have asked me about it. When I chaired House Administration Committee, we would get notices from our CAO that ran our technology sections that the Chinese were trying, and the Iranians, but mainly the Chinese, were trying to hack into the congressional computers. I would send a message to the Chinese embassy, stop it. They would send back a message that would say, this wasn't us. It was teenagers.
Yeah.
We have no control. Yeah, and fine, you know, we didn't stop the House Administration Committee or the Congress over it. You know, we yelled about it, they yelled back and denied it, and we kept moving, which is what you do. Okay, the quote, weather balloon came in. We knew it was a spy balloon. It's now down, and that's it. What will a hearing do? We've had other espionage in this country from other countries, from China before. This is nothing. What is a hearing going to do? Tell us that a balloon came in, you know, and that China sent it.
It's going to give Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Trainwreck Greene and the rest of them their 15 minutes of going, hey, look at me. That's what it's going to do.
And also, it will turn into, you know, Biden should have, would have, could have.
Right.
Is what it's going to turn into. Now, of course, they've talked about Trump. And then there'll be a debate. No, Trump didn't. Did you ever see a balloon when Trump was there? And it's going to, you know, we got a lot of problems in the country. And there's a lot of other things that can go on. This is not like there were fighter jets from China buzzing the United States for 5 hours.
Yeah. No, it's a freaking balloon. What a distraction. Now, I want to get your thoughts on, you know, the big State of the Union. Tuesday, we're going to have the president come out and give a speech. The reality is, you know, country people not happy. What was the latest poll? NBC had 71% of the folks. I think we're on the wrong track. What's the president got to do to turn that around?
Well, and there is another poll too, and the thing I do want to stress about these polls, the other poll is the Associated Press. And it's called NORC, Center for Public Affairs. And the reason I mention that, it's not a Fox News poll, and it's not a good poll, you know, for the president right now. He's went down since the midterms, although the poll is kind of baffling because people aren't saying, in the Democratic side, he's done a horrible job, but they still are diminishing a little bit, obviously, from the November midterms in their support. So I think that the State of the Union tomorrow is going to be the Biden administration doing several things. One, it will address the fact that it reacted to the balloon's going to be part of mentioned. Okay, we're not going to escape the balloon from the State of the Union. The president's going to also say some things about China because Blinken, Secretary of State, canceled the visit. So there's going to be some tough talk there about the president, how he's kept the tariffs, you know, et cetera, how he, you know, hopefully goes into manufacturing jobs in America and, you know, the good paying jobs. He's got to address COVID, where we stand on it, and then he's got to also address the economy, inflation, his point of view of where we're going. But in general, this has to be kind of the kickoff to lay out not his campaign plan before the Congress, but to lay out his objectives, which are going to turn into the 2024 campaign. That's got to be done. He's also going to mentioned something about trying to work together. I know other presidents do it, but this is an extremely polarized environment with a razor edge majority in the House and a small, you know, majority in the Senate. So it's going to be something on that basis. So he's got to lay that out.
No, I think he's got to connect and he's got to say, look, these are my policies. This is my vision. This is what
right.
We've done. This is how we're, things are helping. We may not have seen it yet, but things are coming. And there's got to be that, hey, we're, I feel your pain kind of moment. and not be disconnected. I think it was a huge mistake the other day saying that he's not responsible for the inflation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's yeah. I mean, yeah, he's got, like I said, he's got to lay out. It won't be deemed a political speech, but it'll be deemed a kind of a political map where he's going to go to where he's been. But he's got to lay out where he wants to go to. It's kind of got to be some fresh ideas out there, and I assume, you know, he will do that. There'll be some mention of police, and I think the president will do what he has done effectively, which is to lay out a middle ground on that issue, and I think he'll do that again.
Something that definitely needs to be discussed. Last question on this. Who's going to make a fool out of themselves? Are we expecting the Republicans to Joe Wilson this? Do you think they just sit there with their hands on their hands? And what are we expecting?
I believe they're going to be told in the private caucus, which will occur tomorrow. I believe, Rick, they're going to be told, and this is just from experience of being in those caucuses, when they do tell you things, the speaker usually does. I think they're going to be told that, you know, don't act up, don't scream out, don't yell liar, don't do this, don't do that. I think they're going to be told that. Now, whether everybody listens or not, that's another story. And there's probably, I mean, if I've got to make a guess and a bet, probably somebody is not going to be able to control themselves. Somebody.
Yeah, they're not all potty trained.
You know, maybe Matt Gaetz in particular. You know, he's one that does a lot of foolish things forever. So somebody is not going to heed, because then they'll be, you know, their name will be in the media. And if it's a district that can't stand the president, then they say, you know, yes, I had to do this to stand up for my district. So I don't think they'll heed what I think McCarthy will tell them, which is to behave yourself. I'm not sure that there won't be one or two people that will violate that.
Yeah, I'm sure they're going to, because look, you know, no, I don't think anybody's listening to McCarthy. I just don't. Also, I want to get your thoughts on, you spent years in Congress. I want to get your thoughts on this offer from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Evidently, they're offering a closed door briefing with members of Congress to review the 300 documents. The classified documents that they got from Donald Trump. Any thoughts on this, or do you think this is a dead issue?
Well, no, I mean, it's dead. Look, the documents are dead, in my opinion, in the sense that it is legally a wash. I don't care who had more documents. I don't care that Trump fought giving them. That's, frankly, irrelevant, in my opinion, anyway, at this time. Because it's the problem that the president has now. And again, I know the president cooperated in a different manner. I know the president had less documents, but there were
documents.
One, two, three, four incidences. So it's a political wash for both. And in fact, I think probably Trump and Biden inside people were pretty happy when Pence came out and found something, right?
Joint
misery.
Exactly.
So I think that's a wash legally. It's a wash politically. But this is interesting to share that information. That makes a whole new light on the issue, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering what your thoughts on it, whether this would just be, you know, one of those moments of you know, if you're giving this kind of information, does this become a political back and forth? What happens in this environment if there is one of these closed door briefings? Can those people come out and talk about what they saw? Obviously, not what the documents were, but are they sworn to secrecy? Is there something that could come out of this?
Well, here's how this operates: when you on your opening day, when you take your oath, you sign a document. Now, by the way, not everybody signs that document. I had a couple of cases when I chaired House Administration where we had to inform that member, you are not going to be in on these briefings. And then they get angry, and it's like, it was only maybe two or three members, but they just refuse to sign. So you sign. And what you do when you sign that oath is that, you know, if you go into these hearings and you come out and reveal it, then you can literally, you know, be thrown out of the Congress or potentially, you know, arrested. So.
Right. So when you won't tell me what they showed you to get us involved in Iraq with the aluminum tubes and all that,
right.
This is that.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I would love right now to tell you all this stuff that, you know, we saw. And I would love for them to go back and grab these people and bring them back before everybody to explain themselves. But anyway, that's neither here nor there now. It's classified, can't do it, could be arrested, you know, for it and fined, et cetera. So they're going to have a briefing, but it's probably not going to satisfy lawmakers because they want to review Mar-a-Lago. They want to review, you know, Biden's stuff. They want to review Pence's stuff. And the problem they'll have with this, if they do this, you know, just – Congress-wide with 435, I don't think it rises to the occasion to do this with all 435. Why can they not do it with the, you know, the big eight, the, you know, the top people you've got? You know, you're with Hakeem Jeffries, with McCarthy, with McConnell and Schumer and, you know, some of the other leaders, elected leaders, do it with them and the heads of the Intel Committee. Now, if that's not satisfying Republican and Democrat sides, I don't know what does.
Yeah, but here's
because
the thing.
Because they're going to leak. Somebody's going to leak stuff is what's going to happen if they do it Congress-wide.
And this is where there's part of me that goes, I want them to do it Congress-wide because I want, you know, Marjorie Trainwreck Greene, who's on the, you know, the scariest thing, the scariest statement I saw all weekend was not about the, well, not the balloons, was the fact that Marjorie Trainwreck Greene was going to get security briefings on the balloon. That scared me. The fact that she's on the Homeland Security Committee getting these briefings. That's what scared me.
Right, right. And it's a problem. So that's why you have to sit there and you have to think about something. You have 100 documents, you know, with Trump. You have X amount with Biden, whatever it's up to, I don't know.
It said 300 with Trump, actually.
Oh, was it 300?
Yeah, it said 300.
I lost count. Okay, so we've got all these documents, and why would you go over every single document? I think what you could do is say X amount are light, you know, the first light area of classification. Maybe they could show them what a couple of them are and their nature. That's fine. But when you start to get up to the, you know, to the top of the food chain, and because the point is, how many top secret documents did Trump have or Biden or Pence? Once you get to that level, why do you want to take all that information and have to prove it to 435 people?
Yeah.
They should be able to rely on their leaders.
Not good point. Last question I've got for you. What are you expecting? What are you expecting out of the speech tomorrow? Real quick, what's the expectation?
Well, I think that the president's going to, you know, tackle directly the issue of inflation. I expect him to be quite as bipartisan as he can be, no matter who wants him to be, you know, in either direction. I don't. I mean, I hate to prejudge this, but I don't think it's going to be the wow, you know, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, you know, speech. Nope. I don't think that's going to happen.
No, he doesn't do that.
He doesn't do it. So, I mean, when people anticipate he's got to give the knockout speech, that's not going to happen, you know? I think he's going to just lay out his agenda where he's headed, and then, you move on from that. And so I don't think it's, you know, going to be the knockout speech.
Well, we'll see. And you'll be back for the wrap-up of the State of the Union, and I appreciate that.
Sure,
we'll see you back here after that.
Okay.
Good stuff. Our good friend Bob Ney. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919, marking the first day of the week-long general strike in Seattle, Washington. As World War I drew to a close, many workers in the city were frustrated by 2 years without pay increases due to the war. They expected to see raises once the fighting ended. The Workers' Metal Trades Council proposed modest wage increases, with management refusing to negotiate. The strike was called after a telegram destined for the Employers' Metal Trades Association was mistakenly delivered to the Workers' Metal Trades Council.
Council. In the telegram, Charles Paez, head of the federal government-funded Emergency Fleet Corporation, threatened shipyard owners that any increase in wages could cost them future federal contracts. In late January, 35,000 of the angry shipyard workers walked off the job. Workers from most of the 110 union locals across the city voted to support the general strike. At 10 a.m. on this day, the citywide strike began. As many as 65,000 workers, or one-fifth of the entire workforce of the city, went on strike. Work in the city ground to a halt. Although the strike was well organized and orderly, the mayor of Seattle marshaled both the police and military to use against the striking workers. The Seattle and national press blamed the strike on Bolshevik influences. Some of the unions worried that a general strike was too radical and feared it would ultimately hurt their future organizing efforts. They ended their participation under heavy pressure from the National Office of the American Federation of Labor. Federal agents closed the Union Record, the city's labor newspaper. 39 international workers of the world were arrested as ringleaders of anarchy and blamed for the strike. The Seattle general strike demonstrates how anti-communist hysteria took its toll on labor solidarity.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. So this is one of those weird stories coming out of the UK, and again, shows just how important teachers are. 4 out of 5 UK teachers have reported giving toothbrushes and toothpaste to students because the cost of living is, you know, again, through the roof in those places, and parents are struggling to put food on the table, figuring the roof over their head, this stuff. So dental care, something not high on the list, but you've got this new study that's just come out by the Beauty Banks and the British Dental Association, revealing 81% of teachers, 81% saying that they've given this stuff out. And it made me go, you know, the sad reality is teachers seem to be, unfortunately, like the you've heard that saying, you know what rolls downhill. Well, teachers seem to be the ones at the bottom of the hill catching it all, because they're the ones who see kids who don't have shoes or don't have clothing or don't have food. You know, I've talked to teachers for years doing this program who, you know, they keep extra food in their desk. They keep canned goods in the storage locker so that on the weekends they can give it to kids to take home. They do all of this stuff, and there's no money to help them. It comes out of their pocket. It comes out of the goodness of their heart, because those are their kids. And I hear these right-wing idiots going on about teachers are groomers. No, these people care about the community that they work in. They take jobs that pay less than they could make anywhere else. And considering the amount of money they put out of their pocket for school supplies and displays for their classroom, and then the basic necessities, freaking toothpaste is just, again, failures of policy. That's why I give credit to the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, their president, Randy Weingarten, Tuesday going to be in Florida, in Tallahassee, along with their secretary treasurer and the Florida Education Association president, Andrew Spar, for the next round of their innovation funds, What Kids and Communities Need grant. They've given something like, $1.6 million in funding to go and to help meet the needs of students, help to meet the needs of their members and teachers in the classroom, to help educate kids, where school districts have fallen down, where assaults on funding have taken over. They're there using dues dollars to help make sure that they can toothpaste, freaking toothpaste. I had one teacher tell me that, she literally, buys a bag of groceries for herself, bag of groceries for the classroom. Working in high poverty areas where on the weekends they shove a couple of canned goods in the backpack so the kid will have something to eat over the weekend. Not because they're usurping the parent, but because the parents are struggling. And this is a way to help. And we as a society, I keep coming back to this. you know, for all this talk of forcing women to have children, how about we take care of the ones we got? For all this talk of forcing women to have kids, how about we talk about policies? I mean, there are bans all over this country. There are legislatures moving quickly, showing that they can actually do something when they really want to. You know, how about making sure that kids have enough to eat? How about we ending childhood poverty? How about making sure that kids get what they, the things that they, the school supplies, the dental supplies, the things that they need? How about that? Maybe there's a place to start. Something that could unify us. Instead of things that tear us apart, this could bring us together. I would stand.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.